Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome to The Outlier. I'm your host, Lauren Conlin, and we have a special episode. I am actually in a studio for the first time in a very long time because I have a special guest, Jarrett Ferrantino. So I want to just preface with Jarrett and I were on an episode of Nancy Grace together. You are a decade-long homicide prosecutor. You're the host of True Crime Boss, available on Spotify and YouTube, and you can now be seen on the CW's Crime Nation series.
Yes.
So, are you still practicing law on a regular basis? Are you still taking cases? What's going on with that?
Yeah. So in addition to all that fun and exciting stuff, I do have a law firm in northeastern Pennsylvania where I represent clients. I do all kind of stuff, mostly litigation though, Lauren. Anything that requires going into a courtroom and fighting on behalf of my clients. So yes, I very much, that's my day job, is practicing law in northeastern Pennsylvania. So on the way in, I'm dealing with matters of that. Yeah, so I have been doing that. So in addition to being a prosecutor for 20 years, I started the firm with my partners about 18 years ago. So I have been running that. It's close to the courthouse though, so it's been pretty convenient. But I work quite a bit.
Yeah, wow. And I mean, I guess that doing these media hits and doing these shows must really help and help you get clients.
Well, it helps. And then I get crazy notes and people asking me to help on cold cases and things of that nature, which really isn't what I do professionally. But as I'm sure you do, I get a lot of interesting requests on social media.
You're probably really good about fielding them where I am not.
I have a guy for that. He fields them and anything worthwhile we look into.
Yeah, no, that's great. I want to ask you, I want to talk about your career as a prosecutor. I want to know what was the worst case that you worked on? And when I say the worst case, I mean somebody who was so obviously guilty of, let's say, a murder or some horrific crime, and for whatever reason, he was maybe able to walk, maybe only got a few years less than he deserved. Do you have anything that sticks out in your mind?
Well, whenever anyone asks me that question in particular, I immediately go to the children killings that I've had. I've had cases where babies were murdered violently or a shaken and abused situation. Children where I had a case where a little girl survived and she was confined to this little plastic bed, bound bilaterally with her hands and feet. She had injuries to her that we couldn't figure out what the hell happened to her. I remember just looking at this little beautiful little baby and for a moment wishing that, you know, God would take her and end her suffering because it was so profound. And the injuries are quite permanent. And you know, she's still a little girl. And I don't know what long-term effects her injuries are going to have. She had to learn to walk again. But those are the cases. I mean, her surviving that and the lack of caring both her mother and her mother's girlfriend at the time displayed, and the lies and just the apathy was just so that impacted me in a way that, you know, your typical gangbanger, serial killer, domestic murders don't hit you that way. As a husband and as a parent, I have a little girl, you know, and she's my Achilles heel along with my son.
Yeah.
But that really hit home for me. This child had pieces of her face missing, believe it or not.
So did the mother and the girlfriend get life? Did they?
They are spending the next several decades behind bars. We're exactly where they belong. And that's the satisfying part of what I've been able to do in my career.
And what was the defense that they used for the state of this poor child?
That particular case ended up pleading out. But their defense was ignorance. No one knew how this happened, who was causing these injuries, things of that nature. And it wasn't complicated in the sense where it was going to be tough to prove. It was so jarring, just the crime itself. So to have experienced those and then to go home, and I always tell people, then to go home to your child's sporting event or to dinner with friends, and people want to talk about how your fantasy football team's doing. And this is a job that I don't leave it at the door. I've been unable to do that in my life. How could you? How could a human being, or people tell me, like, take emotion out of it. Good luck. You try that.
Right.
Try that.
Right.
You know, watch what happened to this little girl and her mother lying about it. And the fact of the matter is they're trying to render aid to figure out what happened, and mom's still lying, which is complicating the medical treatment she's getting.
Right.
So it's almost like the abuse is continuing. So that case in particular really hit home with me. But I've had other ones, Lauren, that quite honestly did permanent damage, I think, you know, to me. I like to think I'm a caring person. Sometimes I care too much about the individuals involved in our cases. I grew up in like a Catholic school, and I had all this Catholic schooling, and we learned so much about mercy and compassion for people that I don't know that this is a noble trait in what I'm doing, but a lot of this stuff has really hit home with me. And as now I've retired from the profession of being a prosecutor, and I've really taken time to start looking back and becoming a little nostalgic about it now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, oh my gosh, I don't know how you would take emotion out of it. I feel like a certain point, you'd probably have to compartmentalize, because I don't know when you met your wife, and not to get too personal, but I know for me, like my husband, he didn't really sign up for this, what I'm doing. I started off as a musical theater major. I was an actress and then I went into digital marketing, and now he sees me sometimes just completely shut down, crying over strangers that I don't know. And he's just like, I don't really know how to help you. I don't, you know, and also he doesn't necessarily want to hear about it. Nobody wants to hear about a child getting assaulted. No one wants to hear. And now it's like, you know, so I don't know what it's like for you at home with that stuff, but I find myself like, I don't really have anyone to talk to when it comes down. I mean, I can talk to him, but like, I don't want to upset anybody. I don't, you know what I mean?
Right. And I kind of wear it on my sleeve.
Yeah.
You know, my wife is a physician. She had a chiropractic clinic. She says it's a part-time chiropractic clinic, part-time psychiatry office. So she was always counseling her patients in a way. And certainly, like you, she has her own life going on in her own profession. So she's very understanding. But a lot of things, you know, you just have to keep to yourself and live with. And the way I have been able to, I compartmentalize it. But at the same time, I'm given the opportunity to stick a stake through the person who caused these problems' heart. And that's really where the satisfaction comes in.
Oh, yeah.
The vindication comes in. And quite honestly, most of them you're able to move on from. You tend to fight the fire that's burning in front of you at the moment. And there were plenty of them. You know, to say, like, I wasn't a prosecutor in Manhattan. I was in northeastern Pennsylvania. So, well, how many murders do you have there? Well, we don't have a ton of homicide prosecutors. So when we do have a murder, I and a couple other folks were the ones who did them, no matter how bad they were. So at any given moment, in addition to being a dad and a practicing attorney, I was carrying maybe 100 felony cases and seven or eight homicides at the same time through the legal system. So you just get used to it. You find a way to deal. I run every day. You know, that certainly helps. But really just the work is very satisfying, and you're able to see it through.
Yeah.
You're able to have an end moment in these cases, and you find a way to move on. personally and professionally.
Did you ever reach out, or did the little girl ever reach out to you? Is she older now? Is she?
So she's a little bit older, and that case recently resolved. So she's been adopted by a new family that's absolutely crazy about her. She has a new name.
Okay. I want to make sure she's
doing
good.
She's
okay.
doing great. Okay. And you know, that's another thing. I have kept some of the cases that I've had. I found a way to kind of stay in touch with some of the people that were involved. Some of them, like I said, they hit home, and it matters to me what happens to these folks as time goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's incredibly noble of you, because so many people would just be like, well, that's that. But you're right.
I don't have a choice. Sometimes they call or they reach out too. So
no, but if you're a compassionate person, I mean, this is a good trait.
About any difficult time in your life. You don't forget who was by your side. And I think people don't, you know, we often hear police officers and firemen, they're heroes. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. As a DA, I don't necessarily risk my life every day. But the prosecutors of the world and the public defenders of the world are just on the front lines of this. You know, everybody's in a suit and tie dealing with these crazy cases and sometimes crazy people on both sides. Victims can be crazy. Mm-hmm. A victim can be a defendant before you know it.
Right,
so you're
right.
Oftentimes they're both at the same time. So it's hard to navigate that world and then like I said, you do stay in touch with people. You do stay on top of it. But professionally, you don't forget the people that are there through those dark hours when things are tough and those dark times. And I think victims tend to lean on the people that held their hand through that process. Because I'm going to tell you, as bad as some of their lives have been, the reason they're in that courtroom is probably the worst reason.
Right.
Or the worst thing they've experienced.
Right. And I'm going to disagree with you, because I think what you do is a bit dangerous. I mean, maybe I just watch too many movies, but how many times do you see someone crazy go after a prosecutor in their real life?
It is dangerous. I'm not saying it's not dangerous, but I'm not entering a home with a SWAT team. So in that sense, it wasn't day-to-day dangerous. Believe me, we've had the police at my house multiple times. I've been threatened repeatedly. I don't do this job quietly. I've had two riots in the courtroom in my career. After one of the biggest cases in my career, a member of the defendant's family was charging toward the elevator I was in. So these are things that have happened along the way. But day to day, I wasn't going to work thinking, you know, I'm going to be under fire today. Which is what I mean. And kind of everybody thinks, oh, they're lawyers, they can handle it. You know, no one teaches you this stuff in law school.
Of course, you know what I mean? Do you? This is personal also. But do you? Are you like a trained fighter of any kind?
Karate,
Krav Maga.
Yes,
okay.
I am.
What are? I don't know the gun laws in Pennsylvania. Are they like New York? Do you have to go through a for conceal and carry, 16 hours of training? Do you have to?
Well, not when I got my concealed carry.
Okay.
So no, I don't believe so.
Okay.
But I do. I'm a black belt in Tang Sudo. But
all right.
You asked, so. But
I did.
I did train in martial arts for a long, long time.
Okay.
Mostly for the mental benefit, though, as opposed to like if I'm going to defend myself. A true martial artist will tell you, like, the last thing they want to do is get into a fight on the street.
Right.
It's a little different than when you're, you know, at the dojo or at the gym. So, that was something I think that it gave me a little bit of physical confidence in the courtroom, knowing, hey, if in the event that happened, I would train. We would simulate attacks in the courtroom and things of that nature when I was training advanced hand-to-hand stuff. But fortunately, I did not have to use those skills in the courtroom.
Right. No, you make a really good point. It's the fact that you know that, hey, if something happens, I know what to do and I'm confident enough. So let's go to a recent trial that started this week. I want to talk about the Christopher Greger trial that a lot of people are calling the treadmill murder. And I talked about this on an episode yesterday. I know you talked about it on a recent episode of Nancy Grace, Crime Online. And this video, the treadmill video, it's horrifying. I mean, even Greger's attorney, his defense attorney, said this. You're going to be mortified. He said that to the jury.
Absolutely.
Here's the thing. I don't know the dates of this boy's pneumonia. So the cause, you know, the defense is saying the cause of death is sepsis, and the mother, Brianna Micciolo, signed him out of the hospital too soon. I don't know those exact details. What I do know is that the prosecutor's office, you know, their expert, their medical examiner said, no, he died from the blunt force chest impact and head, which we all saw on camera. So I'm a little confused at which way this is going to go. I don't think this is going to be a hook, line, and sinker here for him to be guilty. But you tell me.
All right. I'm prejudiced as far as the prosecution goes, and I'm biased. But I could tell you which way I think it's going to go.
Okay.
This guy's going to be convicted, and he's going to go exactly where he belongs, which is to jail for a long time. Mm. I understand what the defense is claiming. However, first of all, if you watch that video, here's a couple of things. It's not a blood and guts video. This guy repeatedly throws his little boy back onto that treadmill. And the saddest part is the little boy's trying so hard to run.
Don't even say that because I'm going to cry. Stop
And you know, I don't know if you've ever tried to get on a running treadmill.
It's hard.
It's not easy. And this little boy is repeatedly thrown off. And in that video, he bites the little boy on the head. This father has a problem with rage. So now they're trying to position this as a battle of experts. Okay, there's two things that jumped out at me in this particular case. Number one, that video is what happened at a public gym. You could imagine what goes on behind closed doors if he had the gall to do that in a gym. The second thing that jumped out at me is there is a lacerated, I believe, liver, and his heart was lacerated. So as a prosecutor who's had cases where children, obviously you die of something, okay? And it may be the onset of sepsis as a result of this blunt force trauma. The reality is there is not a natural occurring disease process that lacerates your heart, lacerates your liver. Oh, and by the way, let's ignore the fact that this guy was throwing his son back onto a treadmill, okay? And the child was bruised from head to toe. And it's not only the treadmill incident. Obviously, that one jumps off the page. But this little boy had injuries. Corey was the little
boy.
And he had injuries from his head down to his legs. And they were at various stages of healing. And here's what it says. And the pathologist concluded it's chronic abuse. In Pennsylvania, we call that a course of conduct. So the incident with the treadmill is relevant. And all of these bruisings were at various levels of healing. So this wasn't a moment of rage or a bad day for dad.
Right.
This is a bad life for this little boy. And it kept going on. So all of that, when you say that to a jury, first of all, they're going to be horrified. I can't see how you don't consequence this guy for that video. I know they're instructed not to. Good luck after you see that video. It's gut-wrenching.
It's horrible. I mean, I couldn't finish the whole thing. And I just want to be clear. I agree with you. This monster should absolutely be locked up. There's the probable cause affidavit. I got part of it. And number one, Brianna Micciolo says that he raped her. And that's how she got pregnant. And number two, before this had happened, I think it was like when it first started, when he first came back into Corey's life, because I guess
at the age of four.
At the age of four, exactly. He came back to her sister's house or something, and I don't know if you read this, but apparently Christopher Gregor had kicked a football directly into his face, like at point blank range.
And this guy's an animal.
My whole thing is he is a danger to society. And then upon hearing the fact that his son died, he flees the state.
Well, I mean, here's two other facts. He didn't tell Bree what hospital he was going to. So to me, number one, that's just another dig at her. And number two, he's concealing what's really going on. If your child is naturally sick and something is wrong, obviously, you know, Corey's going to want his mother. Meet us here at this hospital. He's not telling her where he's taking Corey because he's concealing really what's going on.
I didn't know that.
And then he flees. So in court, the fact that he fled, in addition to that prior abuse, you're going to say, by the way, his son, as they claim, is dying of sepsis. He heads for the hay sacks. Why?
Yeah.
It's flight. And in the courtroom, flight is consciousness of guilt, not innocence.
You're
and
right.
The jury is going to get these instructions. Ignore that video. By the way, when Corey was sick and dying, his father was lying and running for the hills. What is the inescapable conclusion here?
You're right.
He's guilty.
Flight is guilt. You're
absolutely
right. I mean, you think of Scott Peterson. I mean, say all you want, but why leave?
Right.
Why flee when they find the bodies? I mean, it's crazy.
When do people run away?
when they're guilty.
Right. Or they have something to hide or run away from.
Yeah.
And that's why it is viewed so strongly in that regard. Under the law, the jury is actually instructed, hey, the fact that dad ran away, you can consider in support of his guilt. So it's very powerful evidence in a courtroom.
Now, how do you think that this is going to bode, though? The fact that, you know, his mother is very young. She was a former drug addict. And look, I know that she's sober. And the fact that she has been writing to the Department of Child Services for, my gosh, I mean, 4 years, I think it was. It's probably 2 or 3 years since maybe 2019 or 2020. And they had not validated any or substantiated this abuse until after Corey had died. So she's suing the state of New Jersey now and the Department of Child Services. But she said, or I guess the defense had brought up that she texted her boyfriend at the time, the day that Corey died, to get her some meth. And not only that, but she and her friends vandalized Christopher Greger's parents' house, throwing eggs and dead fish at it.
Yes, I read that too.
So in my opinion, I was like, that doesn't make her guilty of anything, but it just makes Christopher Greger look better or something.
Oftentimes, as you well know, you cover enough of these trials, they want to put everybody else on trial instead of the defendant.
Totally.
So let's accept the fact. Now, there's no perfect defendant, there's no perfect case, and there's no perfect witnesses. So the vulnerabilities of your witnesses are going to be put on display and highlighted.
Right.
The fact that she has abused drugs or has been a drug addict in the past, okay, well, you accept that. Mm-hmm. And you get that out in your case in chief. If I'm prosecuting that case, I ask Bree that question. Bree, isn't it true you struggle with drugs? Why do people use drugs? To feel the pleasure or to not feel the pain? Mm-hmm. Well, if my child was brutally abused and died, and I have used drugs in the past to escape, what do you think I'm going to do? I'm going to be trying to order up some meth. That's just what happened there. To me, I use it the other way. And you know, talk about martial arts.
No, that's good.
One of the martial arts forms is Aikido, which is where you use the body weight of your opponent against them.
Yeah.
In court, you know, you do judicial Aikido, which is anything that's bad, you spin your way and use the weight of it for yourself. So I would take that situation and say, yes, mom abused drugs. She's looking to quell the pain she's now experiencing and looking for drugs. That does not mean she lacerated his heart, any of those things.
Agreed.
So I think the jury's going to have quite an easy time in dispelling that particular issue. The issue, the civil claim pending now, you have to, and I'm sure you understand, but people have to understand that the court system is often abused, okay? I have told families and I've told couples, look, we're not a marital counseling service. You cannot come in here and say, this person's abusing you 25 times and 25 times walk away from us moving forward in the prosecution. Now, there's a psychopathy to that. I'm not saying there's not. There is. Yeah. There is. And I'm understanding to that. But judges see that every day. So when you have 4 years of Bree making these complaints, many of which seem merited at this point, many of which may not have been, but they get lost in the quantity of what she was trying to do. Now, let me say this. The pediatrician noticed this on Corey, the injuries. And one thing I caught was Corey's teacher.
Yes.
Corey was attending school. So this was post-COVID, shortly post-COVID. Mm-hmm. He was attending school virtually. Mm-hmm. Virtually, the teacher caught those injuries.
Yeah.
So a judge missed it. I'm not saying this judge is Lily White in this. Somebody didn't believe Bree or didn't read that file close enough and missed. And here's the other thing. She was asking for emergency relief. It wasn't a permanent denial of dad's rights. It was, there is enough evidence here to deny him rights till we can get into court and have a hearing. I'm going to tell you this, that civil claim has legs. I mean, there's something
to that. Well, he died one day. That timing is like you die one day after she was denied. And I just was thinking, you know, at first I was like, wow, it's shocking that she was denied. But then I'm like, well, maybe it's her history with drugs.
Well,
it
could be that. Yeah. And I'm not saying, believe me, it looks like Bree was being credible in what she was saying.
But
when you make those complaints over and over again, and there are people that do it, they get lost. They get lost in the volume of what you're submitting. And I could only speculate that that may be what happened here. But if you look at these facts and the people that were seeing the red flags, they were ignored. So there is a viable civil claim here for this family.
I agree. The civil claim, absolutely. You just don't think that, I guess, that the defense is going to be able to show that there is enough reasonable doubt to not convict him for murder in the first degree.
Anything is possible, okay? And when we talk about murder in the first degree, that becomes what intentional acts led to this death. What are the things you did here that took the life of your son? There is any harm to a child is mortal danger. Their bones aren't ready to take those kind of beatings. The things this guy was doing. So the reality is this course of conduct shows that dad had a problem with rage, never took any steps to address it. He knew a consequence of what he was doing could be the death of his child. So you can infer intent from that. And he is likely to be convicted of the top degree of murder that he's facing in New Jersey. He's also facing an endangering the welfare of a child charge. That allows for all that other course of conduct evidence to come in. So yeah. I feel very strongly he's going to be convicted. Anything's possible. But again, I don't see this going his way.
I think after speaking to you, I feel better about his conviction. But I think after watching some of the trial and seeing some of the articles and everything, I was like, oh, gosh, I'm like, I wonder if they're going to have some holes here.
I have to say this. I am sure you can get an expert to say pretty much anything in our profession. Yeah. However, the defense attorney in his case did a nice job. In his opening statement, he fell on the sword. What did he say? You're going to be horrified.
He did.
He's not trying to cleanse this video at all. Mm-mm. That builds credibility. They're saying, okay, we know about the video. We know it's bad. What is his focus? His focus is, this is about the death of this little boy. This little boy died of a natural disease process, which is sepsis following pneumonia. Good luck explaining those lacerated organs. If they're in fact lacerated, what you and I saw suggests that it is.
How does a liver contusion happen? I know we're not in the medical field. I'm just like, how the hell does that even happen?
My experience is those things are brought on by acute trauma. And that is what the prosecution is saying. Now, there were two investigations into court. There were two forensic examinations of his body, both concluding the result was blunt force trauma, which is just striking this little boy all over.
Yeah. When you said how hard he was trying, that broke my heart. I wanted to like hug him and be like, you are loved. You are worthy.
It's always stuff like that. That just, you know, as a human being, and like I said, as a parent, like these are the little things that would jump out at me. Like, look at how hard he's trying. And that little boy would get up onto his own feet and try to get on that treadmill to satisfy his dad, you know, and that's the stuff, like as horrifying as that video is, that's the stuff that spoke to me. And believe me, I would tell that jury, I say, you remember little Corey, how hard he was trying? I want you to go back into that room and you tried that hard to look at the evidence that we've laid out. Mm-hmm. You remember how hard he tried, you know, don't let his little work be in vain or anything like that. I would twist every one of those facts and just keep nailing this guy.
Yeah. You know? No, you got my guilty vote right there.
Well, good. So. See, we convinced you.
Absolutely. And then I want to pivot to, you mentioned a battle of experts. And this is what I am looking forward to in the Karen Reed murder trial. We've had, this is the first week that they have actually started witness testimonies. I mean, it took almost 2 weeks to find 19 jurors, I believe. And I believe they're still looking for one more as an alternate. But this week, it was two O'Keefe family members, I believe. And then it was a handful of EMTs, firefighters, and officers. And then they were actually going to the scene, 34 Fairview Road. So the battle of experts. This has been literally the craziest thing I've ever seen with this 2 a.m. search, the Google search. I don't know if you're totally familiar with that, but yes, no, maybe.
What's the 2 a.m. Google
search? So this was one of the witnesses at the party who came with Karen to early that morning to 34 Fairview when they saw John's body. Now, at 2:27 a.m., her phone, when they subpoenaed her phone, she searched how long to die in the cold. She misspelled it. She said Hoss Long to die in the cold.
Karen searched that?
No, no.
Or her friend?
It wasn't her friend. Her name was Jennifer McCabe. She was a friend of John's and the Alberts. Her sister is actually married to Brian Albert, whose lawn John was
right,
found.
Right, okay.
Dead on, unfortunately. And so she shows up. They see the body between 6 and 7 a.m., I believe. And there's two more searches. How long to die in the cold? So the prosecution, the DA's office, is like, that search at 2 a.m. never happened. It only happened between 6 and 7. And they're saying because Karen asked her to Google that. I have a hard time believing this. I really do, but again, it's going to be a battle of experts here, and people of...
So those would be tech experts, basically saying... So the experts there would say, where's that 2 o'clock, 2 a.m. time coming from? Is mm-hmm. that a Google process? Is it right on her phone? You know, that basically is going to come down to at what time... In real time, was that search made? Was it really 2 a.m.? Or, let me say this. I've had surveillance cameras, okay? Mm. And it'll say 6 a.m. and the shooting happens at 2, okay? So you're looking at a surveillance camera where the clock is wrong.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters, May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Interesting. Okay. How does that happen?
So it happens when they're set up. It happens if there's a power outage where things don't necessarily correspond to the exact time things are happening. So you can rest assured someone is likely to come in and say that 2 a.m. could actually mean right. 6 a.m. That's Central Time versus Eastern Standard Time. I don't know for sure. What I can say about this case is, though, if in fact McCabe made that search at 2 a.m., it makes the defense theory more plausible that something was going on prior to Karen discovering John in the front yard in those early morning hours with the McCabes and with the Alberts and everybody inside.
Absolutely.
However, my experience in more than probably 100 homicide investigations and many, many more that I have followed, oftentimes the simplest explanation, okay, is the truth. Okay, and that doesn't mean it always is, but you have, so imagine this. So Karen's defense is a conspiracy theory, and involved in that conspiracy would have to then be those first responders, the firefighters who come to the scene and they claim to hear Karen saying, I hit him, okay? The children, John's niece and nephew have made statements about Karen's behavior in the days before the time leading up. They'd have to be part of this conspiracy. The science, the lab that analyzed Karen's blood, which is saying Karen's BAC would have been 0.29 or something if you extrapolate that back to the time where they're saying she would have hit John.
Well, that's an expert
all of
opinion.
This stuff, yeah. Right, but all of that stuff you would say supports this thing where Karen drops him off, hits him with her car, takes off, okay? Mm-hmm. It's a bizarre situation, okay?
Very.
And my limited knowledge of I would say this. If all they have is that 2 a.m. search from McCabe's phone, I think an expert could potentially explain that time frame away. However, if they have more of John actually entering the Albert's house and there being a fight.
Well, that's what I think they're also trying to prove with John's phone and his Fitbit or whatever he had on. Did he go into that house? Now, my issue with the I hit him, all that stuff, what we're seeing with the defense this week, with the cross-examinations, it's super interesting because you're finding the fact that it's almost like, okay, so the one of the officers that was on the scene, Officer Serif, or I forget how to pronounce his name, but he literally was by John's body. He was in the vicinity. He was with Karen. He was with Jennifer McCabe. He did not hear her once state that. Matthew Kelly, the EMT, he heard Karen say, "Is he dead? He's fucking dead. He's dead. He's dead." He heard that. There was someone else that heard that as well. And then Katie McLaughlin, and that was this morning and yesterday. And this to me, and I'm probably getting heat on Twitter as we speak, because this bothered me. And I don't want to attack a witness. Like you said, there's no such thing as a perfect witness.
Right.
She went to high school with Caitlin Albert, Brian Albert's daughter. That's where the house party was. Brian Albert is a Boston police officer.
Right.
Canton High School. They graduated 2014. 219 kids in their graduating class. The defense showed pictures of Katie McLaughlin, the EMT, who claims to have heard Karen say multiple times, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him." Shows them partying together. And Katie is like, I guess we're friends, kind of, but we're not really friends. And then Alan Jackson says, "Well, do you know her father?" And she says, "No." And I'm like, hold the phone. I call bullshit here because everybody in my town, I came from a small town, but I went to a high school in another town because my town was so small. We, even in the larger town, we all knew whose parents were cops. That's number one.
Right.
Oh, her dad's a cop. His dad's a cop. Oh, gosh. I mean, especially if you're in the same circle partying. And so I could be completely wrong. Maybe she's completely oblivious. But when she said that, I was like, I just don't think that's very credible. I really, really don't.
So the question really is, too. So, Lauren, you have to look at it this way.
Mm.
If they can show that they have this relationship, could a jury look into that and say, well, they have a friendship and she lied about it. Why is she lying? The next leap of faith you have to take is they're so close she would cover up and frame someone else for murder.
No, I don't think it's like that, like she's so absolutely not.
But really,
I agree
that's
with you.
The question.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not running down the defense. Their job is to poke holes and raise doubt. Karen is pretty defiant in this. I mean, she's given press conferences.
Yeah.
And again, like, I don't want to blow up the Twitter world here because
the reality is
I have not. I'm looking at this from 10,000 feet.
And
I've followed
this. As a prosecutor,
this,
too.
Right. But the reality is this. Like, when your defense is this broad conspiracy impacting different people in different roles, my experience, somebody talks in that conspiracy. And I've broken serial killers to talk about their co-defendants, okay?
Right.
When you're talking about non-criminals, okay, engaged in a well, they would be criminals if they were engaged in this conspiracy, but people that aren't hardened criminals with prior records and things of that nature engaged in this broad-based conspiracy, not to only cover up something that potentially happened to John, but to frame someone else, it's a hard sell. The other thing that jumped out at me about this case was originally Karen was claiming she couldn't remember and she didn't remember taking John over to the Alberts. Here's the thing. If a loved one dies, okay, and this goes back to Murdaugh and this and that, and there is an investigation or people are looking for answers and you're lying, okay, in the initial moments of those investigations, you're lying because you're hiding something. Okay, why, if you had nothing to do with this, are you lying? Your loved one is dead. You're lying about, remember, first of all, I don't remember is complete bullshit.
She stated she doesn't remember taking him
at some point. She said that in the initial call. No, you're pretending you don't remember now.
No,
see,
what I do know, what I do remember and what I was confused about is at first Yannetti was like, she didn't mean to. It was an accident.
Right,
she had no malicious intent.
Right.
And then they get a call from this guy, Stephen Scanlon. And Stephen Scanlon, I don't know if he's going to be on the stand. I mean, I sent an open records request to the Norfolk DA's office. And I was like, I want all emails that have Stephen Scanlon's name on it. And they essentially told me to go F myself because I would be putting him in danger. And I'm like, he made the call. People don't understand.
So Scanlon is, well, that's how it graduated from manslaughter and vehicular homicide to murder.
No, the murder charge came about because they saw that John and Karen were fighting. And Karen said, text that said, I hate you. I fucking hate you. And all these voicemails like that.
That's a tough. See, I look at this, and again, from 10,000 feet, but this looks like a bad accident. Okay. And then she, if to say that she intentionally murdered him is a bit of a leap. Okay. And again, I don't want to blow up the X universe over this, but I'm saying again, take Karen and John out of this. If she backed into him, okay, and he falls to the ground, she takes off knowing she's totally intoxicated, figuring he'd eventually get back into the house or something. That's a far cry from an intentional murder. If she purposely hit him, okay, and you're taking the texts that she has and using that, they're certainly relevant. I don't know if it takes you to the intentional murder realm, though.
But the whole thing is, Jarrett, that I don't necessarily think that all of these people are involved in a quote-unquote conspiracy, meaning the EMTs, the firefighters, the police. However, there's a couple big things for me here, and this is why I think the trial may go in her favor, because I believe that Alan Jackson and Yannetti will bring forth enough reasonable doubt to the jury, because it's so confusing. Number one, you've got the Alberts who, and again, they're viewing their house right now at 34 Fairview, which they sold. Mind you, they're viewing it, and wherever their bedroom is, I guess it's irresponsible that I haven't looked at the floor plan on Zillow yet before talking about it, but forgive me. How do you not come outside when you've got police cars, an ambulance, a woman screaming, is he dead? Is he? I mean, frantic. And also, like, this is, you had a party the night before, a get together. You're not going to come outside on your property and see what's going
on. Well, my experience too with police officers, they're pretty vigilant about their homes, and they know that they'd be watching for anything going on outside. You said you knew whose dads were police officers.
Yeah.
Those weren't necessarily the houses you were partying at, right?
Exactly.
Because you knew, hey, this is somebody you're not going to pull the wool over their eyes. That certainly jumps out at me. But you raised an interesting point. You said the jury's going to be confused or you're confused. And I'm going to tell you this. Confusion is not the prosecution's friend, because a jury is not going to go into the room to deliberate and end that confusion for you or fill in the gaps. That's not their job. And if anybody benefits from that, it's going to be Karen and her team, because confusion is bad. And again, this case appeared very straightforward. It's become totally convoluted and confusing. And that is something that could potentially benefit the defense, quite honestly.
I agree.
The other thing, too, you can't ignore the fact that not everybody loves police officers. A lot of people think one of the questions you ask when you're a prospective, have you ever been a prospective juror in your life?
Yeah, I got myself kicked off real fast.
On that form, they ask the question, are you more likely to believe a member of law enforcement simply because they're a member of law enforcement? The very next question is, are you less likely to believe someone because they're a member of law enforcement? And the way that typically shakes out, certainly in my experiences, you typically get more older individuals saying, well, I want to say the right thing. Yes, I believe law enforcement. They're like, absolutely, right?
And
the defense goes, you know, batty trying to get these people off.
Yeah.
But I found this. You do also get a lot of people that say, I'm less likely to believe. And I would say, why? You know, and I would ask, you have these conversations with prospective jurors, and I would say, tell me what that's about. Well, you know, I've had experience where an officer lied about me or somebody I know, or the press, the media, the movies. You know, there aren't a lot of movies these days about good cops doing the right thing. That's not sexy. It's dirty cops. It's corruption. It's police that go too far, in assaulting someone. And that has colored really how people see law enforcement. Okay. Good and bad. You know, there are people that say, hey, look, police officers risk their lives every day. I want to believe they're doing the right thing. And most of them are. But there is also a contingent out there that, in this case, you have officers that are investigators, you have officers that are victims, you have officers that are witnesses. That view and that lens how law enforcement is seen, mm-hmm. there are people out there that would believe law enforcement would basically contaminate a scene to protect one of their own. And that's going to hurt. That's going to be something that the prosecution has to overcome.
Well, that's where I think that's where we're going with this as well, is that the investigation was incredibly sloppy. And they're arguing that, again, why would Michael Proctor be the lead investigator when he has a relationship with the Alberts? The Alberts are, quote unquote, powerful people in the community. And then you have just small things like the pieces of the taillight not being found until many, many hours later.
Right.
Blood being scooped up with Solo cups, yet cops didn't talk to anyone in the neighborhood. Then you've got the fact that John was missing a shoe and police never went to look for the shoe. Not once, not ever. And then the fact that you've got these EMTs and firefighters saying they heard her say that she hit him, but they never said it to the grand jury and they never told a police officer.
And that's a problem. I mean, those are things like, look, I mean, obviously it's an important point. Everybody's trying to figure out what the hell happened.
What happened?
There. You know, it's weird. In that huge storm was happening both slightly before and then during while John's body was out there. And it's funny, this the crazy things happen in those storms and things of that. So like that scene was compromised by weather as well and complicated by weather too. So, you know, and again, that doesn't bode well for the prosecution. They have to overcome somebody saying it's a sloppy investigation. Things were going on there. You missed things. That does not help the prosecution. They have to overcome those things. And as I said, I've never seen a perfect case. I've seen cases that have been investigated and prosecuted very well.
Yeah.
But I've never seen something that was perfect. And this is far from that.
And now this is what doesn't sound crazy to me, because when we talk about conspiracies, oh yeah, you've got this 50-person conspiracy. It sounds insane.
Right.
The simplest answer works. Karen was screaming at him via text. She was pissed at him. She hit him and she left. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But what would also make sense to me is John got in a fight with one of them when he walked in. They punched him. They said, yo, get the hell out. He passes out drunk, you know, on the lawn. Maybe they figured he would text Karen, come get me. But he passes out drunk. And then he's dead because it's freezing.
Right.
So that also crossed my mind. And then when, just to wrap this up, you talked about the confusion. And confusion is bad for the prosecution. Well, Lally, in his opening statement, I want to say he mentioned, like, some odd 50 names or something crazy, okay? And I was like, yo, I'm confused. So I can't even imagine the jury, because I've been following this case. So how is, like, I was just like, I don't know. I have to think that he is smarter than I think, because he puts me to sleep. I'm bored. He sets the scene for a very long time. But I'm waiting. I'm thinking, okay, does he have something up his sleeve here that he's going to throw at us, you know?
But again, I always say, like, too, if you want to gamble, go to Bally's. You know what I mean? For me, you open with what you got. Like, from the – so that opening statement, and you're saying he dropped 50 names and put you to
exactly,
sleep.
I don't know exactly, but a lot.
Okay. So when you have a case that's that large and you're going to be calling all of those people, okay – I would rather organize an opening statement into concepts and an outline, where you're basically saying you're going to hear this and there are a group of witnesses that are going to say the following. And these are the people that first responded. And these are the experts. And these are the – you basically – what you're doing in that opening statement is – it's like a movie trailer, you know, but you're also – setting the groundwork for your own credibility. Mm. Like when I do that and I'm looking, so I'll lay out a case. I try to be dramatic and tell this story. I always have a theme. And then as the theme's progressing, I would say, like, you know, Lauren Conlon's going to come in here and say the car was red. Well, when Lauren's on the stand and you say it's red, I look over the jury like this. You know, like, I'm built. Remember I told you?
Yeah.
And then I get back up and say, do you remember a week ago when I told you Lauren was going to come in here and she was going to say that car was red? Well, don't you know Lauren came in here and what did she say? You know, and I am at that point augering the point into the ground. So opening statement isn't necessarily a reason to hide anything unless you don't know what's going to come out.
Right.
At that point, you just kind of mention certain things and move on and say, wait till you hear what Lauren says. you know you're going to testify.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you move on.
Yeah.
So like we're expecting her. We're going to call her.
Right.
So, but anyway, okay. Like I said, I know this is one that people have really gone down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
It's an intriguing case. Unfortunately, I've been in Koberger world in my own cases.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I didn't go crazy into the Reed murder.
No, and you shouldn't, because it really, like, I stopped covering it for 3 weeks just because I was sick of hearing how stupid I am from trolls. Honestly, like, I'm going to say, like, I act like, oh, nothing bothers me. And it doesn't really, right. But I am a human. And then, you know, you're saying, and I'm like, was that a stupid question?
I get that a lot on the Koberger. I've been fortunate. I do a lot of the analysis on it. I've done Good Morning America for 2020. I do it on on True Crime Boss, and I get just lambasted on. You're crazy. You're biased. You're this. Well, listen, I'm a realist. All right.
Yeah.
So it's like they'll say the goal of these cases, when you take a look at a case like that, mm-hmm. the goal of the defense is to punch as many holes in those particular pieces of evidence as possible. Okay.
Yeah.
They want to raise as much doubt as possible. However. Okay. Before you even got to Brian Koberger's DNA, for example, you even got there, his car was identified at Washington University. Okay. He physically matched the description. Then his cell phone is those numbers are run through the towers and he's seen in that vicinity 12 times.
Mm.
Okay. So take the DNA out of it. Okay. You got this strange guy. And let's face it, that guy's strange. Like, I like him for this is not a guy randomly plucked off the street. This is let's face it, I like the guy for this. He is weird.
Yeah.
And you know, there's speculation whether or not he's an incel, whatever. The bottom line is he's the kind of guy that's got serial killer vibes, all right?
100%.
Okay? So that means something.
Yeah.
That's a piece of evidence that a jury's going to look at this guy for weeks and weeks and weeks in court and think to themselves, you know what? This is not, you know, some normal guy, mm-hmm. he was studying crime, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
These are things that, and again, these are things that cut against him, all right? Mm-hmm. His strange behavior, his going out, like, hit this alibi where he's out at night.
The stargazing. Oh, my gosh. What horseshit, right?
Who listens to that and says, yes, that's an entirely plausible theory?
I know.
Here's what they don't say. He was home in bed with somebody who can vouch for where he is. That's an actual alibi. This is complete horseshit.
And who turns off their phone now? I don't
know. I know who does. Somebody who's butchering four people.
That's absolutely right. Does. You're so right.
Not only turns off his phone, turns it off the exact time he'd be traveling out there and turns it, whoops, he happens to turn it back on his way back into Washington. Now, pretty convenient. Okay. And again, he's not on trial because his phone was off for 2 hours. He's on trial because in addition to the fact that his phone was off for 2 hours, that phone pinged off those towers. Yeah. He's driving a 2015 white Hyundai. He has bushy eyebrows. He matches the physical description. And guess what? His DNA was found at the scene. So again, I'll give you the phone off. Let's talk about the car. Let's talk about this. These are the things, like, all together, you cannot ignore the case. Everybody comes up to me and says, do you think this guy really did it? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I do.
That's my question, I guess, because I see this group on Twitter who they seem to take up for him and they seem to really defend him.
Right.
And I'm very confused because everything you said, I'm like, yeah, that seems like a conviction to me. I mean, also, I got to say, the Papa Rogers account, he looks like the picture. Looks like it.
Absolutely.
What?
Absolutely.
Like, I don't feel like arguing with people online about this because I just, I have better shit to do. Well, I guess sometimes I don't, but as you look at my replies, you're like, no, this bitch actually does argue. But no, he
absolutely looks like him. It's like, by the way, if you're going to play in that fantasy world, like, you'd think he'd want to be like a blondie with blue eyes. His fake icon looks exactly.
Exactly. Exactly. It's insane.
So I look at this and look, I look at the ingredients of the cocktail that is Brian Koberger, okay? In my opinion, okay? My expert opinion, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of these folks are self-proclaimed experts, okay? I happen to have done this.
Mm-hmm.
I like him for this, okay? However, everything has not come out yet, mm-hmm. all right? Doesn't mean he doesn't have a chance in hell of raising doubt. It doesn't mean there are things that can't be challenged. It doesn't mean his lawyers, they seem to be doing a really good job for him so far.
Clearly,
they're working really
hard. Clearly, he hasn't gone to trial yet.
Right. Well, I mean, and I'm going to tell you about that. So
it's been a very long time. So,
but I could tell you these cases take. So what they're doing, what his attorneys are doing, they're laying this plate of manure on the judge, and they're saying, Judge, we don't even have everything yet. We haven't been able to review this stuff and then have it tested by our own experts. And why I'm saying they're laying this plate on the judge is because when a judge hears that, now the judge is back on their heels saying, well, how can I force them to go forward if they haven't even had a chance to review the evidence personally and then have it analyzed by their own experts? Here's what happens if they fail to do that. The case comes back and you got to do it twice. I've had cases, okay, and I'm not saying I've had cases as big as, there's very few things that have ever gotten as big as Kohlberger. However, I've had cases with 30 and 40,000 pages of materials and dozens of experts and novel legal issues that tie you up for years. Those cases take a mighty long time to get to trial. I believe, and only reading the tea leaves and watching what this judge has said, this case is not going to trial at a minimum until summer of 25, at a minimum.
Holy moly.
If on their best day, that's when they go.
Now, let me ask you, because we're almost out of time. I found this to be super odd. Why would they tear the house down now?
Well, okay, so you said they're going to do a view in the retrial. They're going back to the scene because that scene, whether or not she did that 3-point turn or 4-point turn,
yeah,
they want to look at everything,
right,
where the Albert's bedroom was.
Correct.
That particular scene in the Kohlberger case is a relatively straightforward scene. It's a hallway. There's a couple of rooms. Both the prosecution and the defense have had multiple opportunities to go through there, and the scene has been laser mapped too. So you're going to be able to recreate that scene in the courtroom. My belief is this. The preferred thing would have been that thing stands. I don't think it's detrimental to the prosecution's ability to put on their case because they'll be able to recreate much of it through video, through photographs. And the how hard is it to understand? Kohlberger walks down the hallway. He passes Dylan on his way out this side door. You don't, and I'm going to tell you, it's the exception that a jury would go to a scene. In this case, they probably would have been granted that right. Judge is a fair judge, and I think they would have been able to do it. I don't think that house being gone is going to hamper the ability to prosecute this case. However, okay, it would be preferred if it was still standing, but not insurmountable that it's down.
But what I mean, and I just don't know. Did the parents of the victims agree to this?
No. And I'm going to, that's an interesting point.
Yeah.
So one thing, and I don't know if you know, I've had the honor of representing the mother of Brittany Drexel and the Drexel family through the Brittany Drexel case in South Carolina. And when the communication between victims' families and the prosecutors breaks down, you have these divergent messages coming out. And you have that with the Gonsalves family and the Kohlberger case. I don't know what is going on with the DAs and these families. However, you're getting mixed messages, again, which is something that doesn't bode well. They should be working in tandem and communicating together. The way, if that house was going to be torn down and there wasn't much that could be done about it, or it was part of some plan by the prosecution, those families come in, you sit down and you explain exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
And I've said this to families, do not go out on the steps of this courthouse and take a run at me in the press. I'm not going to be happy. I've said it.
Yeah.
You can do what you want.
Right, right.
But these meetings are going to continue. Don't do it. I wouldn't recommend you do it. Okay. So the difference, I use the Drexel case, for example, we were regular, and this case dragged on for 13 years. I came in the last several years where there were developments and they ultimately found Brittany's body and prosecuted Raymond Moody. But the investigators in those final years were an open book with Dawn and her family. They would bring them in. They would telegraph where we were headed. And my job really was to kind of translate for Dawn and say, look, what they're telling you is legitimate. What they're telling you, because she'd been told lies for years and years and years. And Dawn Drexel is, she's amazing. And she is one tough mom. I mean, she's the best. But what I'm not seeing in the Kohlberger case is the communication with, you know, Maddie, Ethan, and their families. Like, there's a breakdown there. And Mr. Gonsalves in particular is out there. He's being interviewed.
Yeah.
He's expressing frustration. Even how long it's taking, you have those conversations. Say this, believe me, they're not easy conversations.
Right.
I've had to tell families, hey, we're off for a year. Okay. But guess what? Here's the answer to that. Kohlberger's sitting in a jail cell. Our case isn't getting weaker by this. We're going to be ready. But you got to understand something. We can't go. Or do you want to do this twice? Do you want your daughter's brutalized body shown to a jury and you sit in that courtroom over and over again and this case get covered over and over again? Do you want to do it twice or do you want to get in the right way? That's the conversation. And I don't think it's being had.
Wow. Yeah, no, you make a really good point. I mean, he's sitting in a jail cell. But I think all of us are just eager to, and this sounds horrible because it wasn't my child, but it's like, I want to put this behind me as well. I'm sick of that stupid face. I mean, because I talk about this a lot, but you know, so many of these cases, we splash the face of the murderer across the news, across everywhere. And I'm sick of his face.
Well, and I can tell you, in this case in particular, though, I think that these beautiful young, beautiful people have received a tremendous amount. I think it's been pretty split.
I agree.
But I do agree with you that oftentimes, you know, these active shooters are highlighted too much. The defendants are highlighted too much. And it romanticizes it for the nut jobs of the world.
Oh, you're right.
And they don't spend enough time focused on the prosecutors who are working really hard.
No, you're so funny.
Very few.
Jared, tell everybody how they can find you on social media.
So on social media, we're on Instagram, True Crime Boss Show. We're on YouTube, True Crime Boss. I think if you Google me, Jared Ferrantino, jaredferrantino.com comes up. And if you're in Northeastern Pennsylvania and need counsel, you can hire our firm and we'd be happy to represent you.
I love it. And you need to get back on Twitter.
I will do that.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you so much
for joining
the Outlier. I feel like I learned so much. Oh my gosh.
Thanks. Me too.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.